Welcome to a bonus episode of the Sean Chandler Podcast, a place to talk movies and nerd stuff way too much. This is a very special extra episode where Griffin and I got to interview film and television composer Mark Isham. He actually composed the score for one of my favorite movies of the last decade, Warrior. He currently is out promoting a new project he just did called Little Fires Everywhere. It's a series for Hulu starring Reese Witherspoon based off of a book. And we got to talk with him for over 40 minutes about a little bit of everything. We talked with him about kind of how he got started, what is his process. We talked with him about Little Fires Everywhere. We spent about 10 minutes talking with him about sports movies, in particular the movie Warrior. I had some questions about the score, about the soundtrack to it, and he had some very interesting answers. And then one cool little thing that came out of this, he's currently working on Bill and Ted Save the Music, or Face the Music, and I asked him about that a little bit. He was able to give us a little bit of an update because he's been watching the movie to score it. And so that was a nice little detail. He recently worked with Steven Spielberg on Amazing Stories. So we were able to touch on a whole bunch of different stuff. Because of that, you can look down in the description or the show notes with the time codes to kind of see which particular topic you might be interested in. Because we really did cover a ton of different stuff. And if you want to jump ahead to one of those, you can do that down below. With that said, go ahead and enjoy. This was a real pleasure. Just a really neat thing that I got to actually interview the composer of one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years, and he really did have some cool things to say about it. Just to kick things off, can you introduce yourself so that the audience can get to know you from your perspective?
Of course. My name is Mark Isham. I'm a recording artist and composer for film and television.
And how did you get started composing? What was the process for that?
Well, my mother tells me that at the age of 5, I used to sit down at the piano and bang out dark chords and then happy chords and tell stories. And I think it was always just something that was natural for me to want to write music and tell stories with music. I became a jazz musician, though, in my teenage years and spent the first decade of my career touring the world and playing jazz and then guesting with various pop artists and rock artists over the years as well. And I got a lot into electronic music and a lot of different genres of music. And I was really intrigued by mostly esoteric music, though. I was never much of a pop guy. And somebody offered me the opportunity to score a film. And I had enough background and enough esoteric music, including orchestral music, because I am classically trained, that I could do it. I didn't know I could do it. I'd never studied it, but I had enough knowledge and experience in a lot of different types of music that it actually came reasonably quickly for me to do that job.
So who are some of the kind of composers and artists that kind of influenced your, kind of sparked that initial love? Who are those specific artists that kind of made you love music?
Well, that's a pretty diverse list, yeah. I must admit. Having grown up in a classical household, my mother was a concert violinist and my father was a professor of art and music. I was sort of steeped in, I knew who Mahler was long before I knew who the Beach Boys were. So grew up listening to string quartets on the weekends in my parents' living room and things like that. So I think Mahler was probably the first composer that I bothered to ask my mother, what is that? Because it emotionally sort of really grabbed me. But by the time I got into high school, jazz took over and Miles Davis became my guru and my leading light for many decades, actually, because he obviously had such a tremendous impact upon the jazz world, but also the pop world to a degree. He had interacted with the pop world in a very fascinating ways, and there was a great exchange with him and the entire musical culture, I think. And then bands like Weather Report and Chick Corea and Mahavishnu Orchestra, these bands that brought rock and roll into jazz. And then consequently, the pop musicians that were exploring other ways of doing things, like the Talking Heads and David Bowie. Brian Eno was a huge influence on me when I discovered him. So that was pretty much my education through my early part of my life.
Well, I just kind of wanted to piggyback off of your background as a jazz musician, because I feel like that's a background you see I don't want to say like a lot of composers, but you, like, I've noticed a lot of composers have a background in whether it be jazz or electronic music, and like being able to transition into film scoring kind of gives them the best of both worlds, per se. So I'm curious for you, because it feels like your path always led to performance. What did scoring offer you that performing didn't? That, like, what was that thing that gave you like the kick to kind of like go in on scoring?
I think the first scoring experience showed me that, well, to be blunt about it, that a company with rather large resources, first of all, would pay me reasonably well.
Yeah.
Give me resources like an orchestra and a recording studio and things like this to work in. And these are very, very hard for a jazz musician or anybody, unless you've reached the very pinnacle of your profession, to have access to those sorts of resources. But film companies do have access to that, and they want that quality and that largesse in their scores. And I think that experience coming off my film score and having had someone work with me to orchestrate it for orchestra and to bring in specialists on Tahitian war drums and Chinese flutes and all these exotic instruments. These are things that are, you know, on one's own budget would be very, very difficult to pull off. And but if you have the Disney Corporation in back of you, it becomes a little bit easier and quite a bit of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can imagine. Well, and then just, you know, kind of on the flip side of that, having done both sides, what does performing offer you that, say, like film composition doesn't?
Well, performing, of course, it's yours. It's you're in charge. It's your band. It's your interaction live with an audience. I mean, that experience can never be replaced. I mean, yes, if you stand in front of a 75-piece orchestra and hear them playing your music, that's a pretty great rush. But if you're playing in front of 1,500, 3,000, 7,000 people, and they're all clapping and singing along, that's a pretty great rush, too.
I have to imagine,
And that is your rush. That's there because of something that you have constructed, you have built, you have worked hard to get on your terms exactly the way you want it. And so there's something very, very rewarding about that can be hard to replace by anything else.
So jumping off one of the things you mentioned earlier about having just such a diverse set of influences and things that you're interested in, some composers have a very distinct sound. Like, I love James Horner's scores, but they have a sound. Like, you know a James Horner score when you hear it. But with yours, each one of them has a distinct vibe to it. Is that a conscious decision, or does that just kind of come from just having such a diverse set of influences and interests?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I have a tremendously diverse and rich musical background over the years. But I think that one of the composer's jobs is to sort of define a musical universe for a film and get very specific and to get pretty unique if one can. Obviously, budget can be a guiding factor. I like to look at it as a guiding factor, not as a hindrance. Because sometimes it's those movies that, you know, the director has, as several directors have said, I've got 10 cents, Mark, you got to do this for me. You know,
so actually on that, what does that look like? I've never thought about budget in terms of composing. What does that look like when it comes to a film?
Well, in this day and age, computer technology allows us to build a pretty comprehensive score in a computer in your bedroom. And so But I can tell you, when I started 30 years ago, that was not the case. You needed at least an 8-track tape machine. And a few instruments and the ability to record. So obviously at this point, unless you're a trained engineer, you have to have a team. You have to have people come and help. You have to be able to build this stuff. And then if you want anything organic or acoustic, you got to put people in a room and you got to know how to record them. You got to know how to mix them. So obviously those are expenses. They start adding up. So you need, you know, I did The Times of Harvey Milk, which was an Academy Award winning documentary, as my second film. My first film was for Disney, and I never even knew what it costs. I just said, could we do this? And they would say yes, or they would say no. I have no idea to this day what that score cost them to make, because they just paid for it. My second film was a small independent movie. I knew exactly what everything cost because it came out of my pocket. So you learn very, very quickly when you're paying for this stuff yourself exactly what you need to do, what you can do, and what you should do, and what the film really needs, what you can't cheapen out on, and where you need to put your money.
Yeah, well, and I mean, obviously, a lot has changed. I mean, as you kind of spoke to, a lot has sort of like changed over the course of, you know, composition. Well, not just composition, but the industry as a whole, from when you started to where you are now. One of the things that I've noticed, and I think a lot of people can probably speak to this, is that, like, you know, big fanfares and melodies seem to be less common in the traditional sense, and like a lot. You know, these days people, like, a lot of pieces seem to be relying more on like rhythmic, percussive and bass scores. Like, what do you personally, as someone like sort of involved in the creation process, what do you make of the change? And do you still think that like filmmakers and audiences still want those like traditional motifs that you see in, like, you know, not only your work, but like Alan Silvestri or like a John Williams per se?
You know, I think there's room for all types of scores, and I've done all types of scores. I've done scores where there's not been a traditional melody at all. I think I got away with a three-note motif, and this is, and that's as much as we could do to bring any sense of traditionalism into it. And it wasn't that I disagreed with it at all. I thought it was a great choice for the film, and I thought it fit really, really well. I've also had the great fortune to being asked to write very traditional scores with, you know, three or four different themes and bring the themes together and have an orchestra play them and have that tune that you can whistle as you leave the theater. And I think they're all approaches are valid. I think as long as the director has a very clear vision of what that film they're trying to make, and that the composer duplicates that vision and finds the right tone and the right size and the right genre to score in, it's all wonderful and valid in my world.
Kind of to that point, like, what does that process look like to meet with a director and try and capture his vision, since music is so just crucial to finding the tone, the vibe, the emotion of a film? What's your process of kind of having those conversations that leads to the music that creates that?
It is a process. That's the perfect word. And the other word there that's crucial is conversations. It's talking. It's getting a line going, back and forth, discussions and experiments and trying stuff. There's a process in the scoring process called the temp score, the temporary score. And this is usually put together by editors, music editors, sometimes with the composer's involvement, sometimes before a composer is hired to help the filmmaker decide which composer might be the best composer for their film, depending on the type of music they like. And they can put a, you know, Adele song in there. They can put a Hans Zimmer score in there. They can put a Haydn symphony in there and just see what makes this film come alive. What's that texture? You know, is it a Nine Inch Nails record played backwards? I mean, what is the texture of this stuff that's going to feel like it belongs in the universe of this movie? And so if a composer is involved in that stage, then it's observing that and discussing that and saying, look what happens when, you know, when that sort of musical gesture goes with that character's face. Look at that. Okay, is that something that will sustain itself across an entire score? And you just keep plugging away until the truth is revealed.
So moving to Little Fires Everywhere. So with a project like this, it's based off of a book. When you're scoring a film based off a book, is part of that process, would you read the book? Did you read the book for this particular project? Or do you just want to go through the conversations with the director?
On this particular project, I did not read the book. There are times when I definitely have read the book beforehand. Excuse me. But it was mostly a scheduling problem. I got brought in at a time where it was going to kick in pretty quickly, and they had scripts already. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to just start with the scripts and get right in from the get the writer and the producer's point of view right from the top.
So the other interesting element with this particular project was the collaboration with Isabella Summers, and you mentioned it kind of coming late. Was how exactly did that collaboration come about? Because it seems like a very interesting, unexpected collaboration.
It is. And to the best of my knowledge, Mary Ramos, who is one of the top music supervisors in this business, she's done all of Quentin Tarantino's movies, and she was brought into this project first. And it's a very... Part of the whole structure of this project is mostly women. It's produced by women. It's written by women. It's showed, run by a woman. And they were interested in seeing if there was a woman composer. Mm-hmm. Mary had done a few things with Isabella and said, I think Isabella could be great for this. And they said, that sounds fantastic. And then Dawn Soler, who's the president of music at ABC, who produces this, said, you know, I really think you need someone experienced. I think Isabella would be great, but she's never done this on her own. 8 episodes of television back to back. It's pretty daunting if you've never been through it before. And let's pair her with somebody who's got a tremendous amount of experience, but who would also have the sensibility to work with her. And Mary said, who would that be? And Dawn said, I think it would be Mark. And Mary said, oh, I know Mark. In fact, Mary and I had done some film work together before. And she said, that sounds like a great idea. And that was that's how it came about.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So with the 90s setting, I watched the first couple episodes last night with my wife, and very much incorporated because of the 90s setting. There's kind of pop music sprinkled throughout it. What is the process by which you kind of, there's the integration of the composition plus the soundtrack. Is that the music supervisor that kind of guides all that?
Yeah, in this case, Mary sort of captained that particular ship. She and Dawn, and then Isabella and I got involved as well, sat down and wrote out what each one of these characters would listen to. What's on Izzy's playlist? What is playing in her headphones when she's wandering around pissed off at the world? When Mia's, you know, working on her art and has the headphones on, what is she listening to? And we came up with... mostly Mary and Dawn came up with these playlists that these gals would be listening to and then informed Izza and I of that. And so we were sort of given the world that these various characters would inhabit musically and the way they would want their emotions expressed musically by these various different bands and artists. And that influenced us to some degree. We also produced a bunch of the covers.
Okay. That was another one of my questions. Yeah.
Yeah, so we had a big part in picking those covers and, in fact, did produce 5 of those covers.
Okay, gotcha. Oh, very cool. That's where, as we got to the end of the first episode and one of those kind of kicked in, and my wife, who loves both, you know, wife and I are both 90s kids. We're in high school during the time period of this. And so she's like, what? Oh, it just got real excited. And it's just even the nature of the cover is kind of her style of music. And that new version of Sex and Candy, she's like, oh, this is amazing. What is this? So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, we did some good ones. We did that great Phil Collins tune, Air Tonight. We've done a couple of Alanis Morissette tunes, which, of course, are great. Angry songs in there. So they're
so all the songs I grew up with.
Yeah. Coming up in episode 6 is a fantastic version of Bitch, if you remember that song.
Oh, absolutely I do, yeah.
Nice,
everything
yeah.
you're saying, that, those are my formative years of the songs that I was listening to as an angsty 17-year-old at the time. So absolutely I know this one, so I'm looking forward to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So like with a show like this that kind of has a suburban suburban kind of mystery, racial, social, political or social economic tensions, like where do you kind of try and find the themes for that to make it stand out?
Well, that's a good question. If I had a simple answer, I think my job would be a lot simpler.
It's true.
It's a trial every single time. I don't know if there is, it's as far as I can see, and Iz and I didn't come up with any new magical solutions. It's just, you get in the room and you start going.
Yeah.
You just have to, you can talk for as much as you want about the influences. You can say, oh, remember that song? Remember that? How about if we do something? Yeah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, it's when you wait and you look at each other and say, you know, that's pretty damn good. That's all right. And how you get that, it's the work. You know, you just dive in and you do it. And I wish there were a magical answer, but I'm afraid it's that hard.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you also have another show currently, I mean, among, you know, a million other shows that you've been working on and whatnot, but you've also scored the sort of reimagining of Amazing Stories, which I believe the original version of that came out in like 85 or something about that, but like kind of towards the beginning, the earlier years of your career. And I'm curious, you know, now scoring the reimagining of it, did it allow you to go back to, you know, some of those formative years and sort of like play in the same sandbox that you did, you know, back in the 80s?
You know, the stories aren't set back in that time. The stories
are in
a contemporary time. I think the one tip of the hat we did to the original, and just the fact that Steven Spielberg is still involved in this, and Steven has very specific ways that he loves to use music. He loves the traditional, he wants that 8-bar theme. He wants that secondary theme. He wants to hear them intertwined in Act 3. I mean, he loves that stuff.
Yeah,
and even though he wasn't directly directing what I did, the two guys that were, I've worked with a long time with, and they have very similar tastes. They want that tradition. So I dove in that way. Having said that, I also did it in a very contemporary, you know, 2019 sound to the whole thing. So because that's what the characters are, they look like it. You don't feel like you're in a retro period.
Yeah, no, I definitely got a sense of that, but I was just kind of curious to hear your standpoint of it. But you did mention Spielberg was involved in the music process, which I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that, just given, you know, the nature of how he works. But I was a little surprised to hear that. So I guess, what is it like working with Steven, and like what are those sessions like? What are those conversations like?
I think I never did it in person. it was always via, you know, the magic of the modern communication systems.
Yeah.
I think a lot of his notes had been given previously to the producers as they were working in some of the temp score ideas. And so when I went in and reviewed all the material and the temporary music they had in there, a lot of the ideas said, oh, Steven made a specific note about this. When the little boy walks to the mirror and he sees that thing, he loves this sort of gesture. So I had a lot of things written down that were very Steven specific, so that on my first pass, I made sure I did not ignore or not pay attention to very specifically any of those things. So that by the time my pass went to Steven, I think pretty much all of his concerns had been already looked at. And I had, well, I don't know if I ever got a specific change note from Steven directly. I think he loved everything because I did my homework and I was very sure that I was doing it the way that he had expressed that he wanted it done.
Yeah, well, I guess that's like, you know, arguably the best compliment you could get, you know, working under him and stuff. But I do want to switch gears a little bit here and move into a genre that you're pretty much the go-to guy, I would imagine, for this genre, which is sports films. So, like, you scored a number of sports movies from, like, The Express to Miracle, which is personally my favorite sports film of all time, Warrior. And so I'm curious for you, kind of having done a number of them and understanding what makes a good one work, what is the key to, like, truly unlocking the sound for a great sports score?
That's a good question. You know, it's. I think it's understanding that sports. And this is funny because I never played sports as a young man. I am the least athletic person you can imagine. However, I have three sons, all of whom played sports. Two of them played college football, and one of them made it into the Pac-12 and was on television.
Wow. So,
I have, in my family experience, a lot of big-time sports. So, as I've observed it in film and in life, it's sports sort of bring together that human experience that we've experienced, you know, throughout the evolution of the human race of going to war, having a side that you believe in, protecting that side, teamwork of that side to go and win the battle. And I think that's such an archetypal emotion that we have just as a culture been through, even though in our generation we haven't experienced that personally. But it's part of our culture. It's such a huge part of our culture. And I think it's why sports are so popular, is because we get to relive and be a part of the adrenaline and the excitement and the emotion of that fundamental part of our global culture. And I think if you understand how to represent that in music, and I just thought of this because you're the first person that's really sort of probed this question to this degree, but I think Gustav Mahler, the German composer who I was introduced to as a very young child by my parents, has the ability to represent that in his symphonies. And I the fact that I grew up listening to my mother listen to those symphonies just ingrained that sense of what it is for music to express triumph, the bitterness of defeat, the rising up from the ashes to go back and win in the fourth quarter. Emotions are, right? And how archetypal they are. And it's fun as hell to do too. It's really, you can stir people's souls and you can get grown men to cry. And if you can, fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know Sean can speak to this. Sean's favorite sports film. Yeah, exactly. You're Warrior.
Right, yeah. Speaking of grown men crying, Warrior is, I mean, top three movies for me of the last decade. And I mean, exactly what you just talked about of so many emotions, the victory, but it's also this deep family drama. And a big part of that movie is the music. And that's the score, and it's incorporating Beethoven, and you've got the Nationals. What's the process of on that, like collaborating? Is it that music supervisor cut with Gavin O'Connor coming in to like give kind of this vision for how those pieces kind of come together?
Well, I've worked a lot with Gavin, and most of the time we've not had a music supervisor. Gavin does his homework.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Gavin brought the National in. Gavin brings pretty much any song comes into his film. He's the one that's been driving around with playlist after playlist, listening and brings them in. The picture editor on Warrior, well, we went through quite a few, but John Gilroy ended up finishing the picture. And he's very musical as well, and he would put music in. And I made the unfortunate quip of you know, in that montage scene when they're training and Frank Grillo turns and says, listen to the Beethoven,
which is my next question. about that.
I made the unfortunate quip of saying, I suppose we have to try Beethoven at some point so that we can decide not to do it, right? Definitely thinking we're going to decide not to do it. Well, of course, I tried it and it works fucking great.
Right, right.
yeah.
So that completely went against any plan or any previously conceived idea that I had, but it latched onto the film and it's hung in there and it stayed to the bitter end.
And it ties into the story. I mean, it's like it's a plot point. And I mean, so much of it, my question that I had written down was, did he come to you with Beethoven's Ninth and be like, hey, can you put Ode to Joy in the training montage? But that's interesting the way that played out.
Well, they tried that. They tried the original, you know, an orchestral recording in it. And that's when I said, yeah, well, that doesn't work, does it? And Gavin, you know, smart ass Gavin, he said, well, what about if you did something?
Yeah, he's like forcing you to come full circle with your childhood in a way.
Exactly. And thinking, of course, I'll just do this quickly. I'll bang it out in an afternoon or two, and we'll all agree that it doesn't work. And then, of course, oh, my God, it's actually pretty great.
That's funny.
Another piece of music in that one that's interesting is the movie ends on the Nationals doing About Today, and the whole movie crescendos to this song. And my understanding is that's a different version from what's on their album version. Is that something that you worked on, this version of it? Or is that something just they did entirely?
That's a very interesting point. It's a live version that they did on French radio in a radio studio. And this is where Gavin, again, I mean, he'd known the National and he'd turned me on to the National years before. But he called me up and he said, look, I've got a National song. I said, okay, good. He said, no, I found this live version where the ending just goes on and it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds. And I know that this is the way that this film needs to end. So it was a bit of a legal thing, because not only did the National have to sign off, then they had to go to French radio. They had to discover who might own the actual master recording. They had to see if there was a better recording than this MP3 that he had. So that was the hardest part of all of that. And then we met with we played it for the National. I remember we flew to New York, met with them, played them the scene, and they loved it. And I turned to them and I said, look, would you allow me to orchestrate once that build at the end goes? Because I want the size of this thing to be able to match the score that we've had. And we've had some pretty big moments. And they said, yes, please. That would be fantastic. So once they get into that build, the orchestra comes in and just wraps itself around the National. And I don't disagree with you. It's maybe one of the top three films that I'm the most proud of.
Oh, I cannot tell you how many times my wife and I have rewatched it. And the way on my YouTube channel, that's the movie I recommend the most to people, like, because it's so underwatched and everyone that sees it loves it. So I did a big recommendation back in January, my best of the decade, every single day, someone private messaged me, thank you so much for recommending Warrior. And I always say about like the whole last hour of the movie is just nonstop, victory moments. And so much of that is just the score coming in at just the right time, those victory moments. And then that crescendo at the end is just, I can't think of any other movie that just crescendos so much on that final moment so well. So wonderful, wonderful job. As I said, I love that movie. And you're a huge, gigantic part of that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. A few more questions, kind of close things out. You've done so many different things, different genres, and you know, you've done time travel cop movie with Van Damme doing the splits to sports movies to suburban dramas. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you'd like to do?
I'd love to do a Marvel film.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
If just because I think that they're sort of defining whatever this new big pop culture world of films is, and Plus, they have so many resources. You could try all sorts of tremendously interesting things, you know, that they could afford to try. And that would be, you know, choirs and God knows what. I can't even imagine what one might possibly do, but that would be fun. I did do an animated film 2 years ago. That had been on my bucket list. I wouldn't mind doing another one of those. Those are a lot of fun. They're a lot of work because there's a lot of music. And you have to really step up and really tell the story in animated movies. But it's a challenge that I really enjoy. So those are always good to do.
And speaking of Marvel movies, you know, kind of the modern era of comic book movies kicked off with Blade. And so in certain ways, you were a part of that. That was the one that kind of corrected the ship after some DC movies made things some kind of goofy. And then Blade was like, wait, we can do a serious one. And that kind of paved the way for some future things that happened. So another one that you were a part of, something that I love Marvel movies. Those are the things that my channel's kind of known for. So I would love it if that happened as well. On some future project stuff, I guess you're listed as being the composer for Bill and Ted Face the Music. Is that the case?
That is very much the case. I'm in fact Bill and Ted Face the Music. I just submitted another reel the other day.
That was kind of my question. So with everything going on in the world, is that kind of imposing some or delaying some of your work, or are you able to kind of make progress on everything because of the computers, as you mentioned earlier?
Well, I sort of make the unfortunate quip that I've sort of lived a semi-quarantined life as a composer. I think a lot of people in my business, you know, spend 10, 12 hours a day in a room all by themselves. And I think writers face that same situation. Fortunately, because I am employed right now on a number of projects, I have plenty to do and I have a room I can do them in and send out for food. So
yeah, I guess
the main issue is, yes, how do I then, I love people coming out here. We have a nice big screen and the sound, of course, is really good and presenting my work in an environment that I can control. If I'm sending this stuff to them, God knows if they're watching it on their iWatch or, you know, can I shoot myself now, you know, I make my directors swear that they will hook up good speakers to their computer and try and at least get somewhat of the experience of listening to it properly.
So I guess that means that you've seen pieces of Bill and Ted Face the Music. Can you tell us anything about it?
Yeah. Well, in my humble opinion, I think it's the best of the three.
Excellent.
Yeah, most excellent. And Alex and Keanu are just as funny, probably funnier, actually, because they you know, now they're seasoned veterans and they know exactly when to do exactly what. Plus, we've got a really, really good director. Dean Pariseau is probably, I mean, Galaxy Quest is still one of the great farcical movies of all time, and so his skill at that is already proven. So he's done a really, really good job. And I'm having a blast. It's a nice change after having been very serious with Little Fires and very dramatic, and we've gone straight into the complete absurd.
Yeah.
So to kind of close things out, on my channel, I'm kind of known for like the guy that does top 10 best of lists. So just a couple questions for you. Who are some of your favorite film composers of all time?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I am a big fan of Tom Newman. I think he came in and with a very unique voice at a time when people wanted that voice and He's just wonderful. I have to say John Williams because he's sort of in a class by himself. And another guy who I really liked and I haven't seen much of him recently is Elliot Goldenthal. I think he is again, he's the real deal. He really knows what he's doing and when he wraps his wraps his wits around a score, it's always going to be intriguing and really thoughtful and very emotional.
And then the follow-up question to that one, what are some of your favorite film scores of all time?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm not going to say this is in the order, but it's interesting that the first film score that comes to me is actually by Hans. And I would have to say I've come to admire Hans over the years, especially the last 10 years of his work. I think he's really, he's found a way of being Hans that is really quite wonderful. And his score to Inception is knocked my socks off and still does when I hear it.
That's got to be my favorite of all time.
obviously Tom's score to the first Sam Mendes film, what was it?
American Beauty.
Yeah, American Beauty. And then The Player. He followed that up with The Player, which was
good as well.
those are wonderful scores. That way that Tom writes is beautiful.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. What else? I mean, I love some of Ennio Morricone's scores. I think he's like the opening to Untouchables. That opening title theme is pretty great, pretty unique. And I also want to mention Danny, because Danny, to pick on the guys who I mentioned as my favorite composers, Elliot scored an Alien. I think it's Alien 3 that he did, is quite a piece of work. That's tremendous. All right.
That'll work.
Yeah, this works.
Anything coming up in the future that you just kind of want to let audience know about, that you're excited about, that you're working on?
Well, I'm going to be starting. In fact, I have just started on the first initial trial runs on Lee Daniels' new film, which is, again, back into very serious mode. But as Lee described it, it's the story of Billie Holiday. And not just the story of Billie Holiday, it's the story of the American government through J. Edgar Hoover, who decided to take her out, take her down. He felt she was too much of a leader in the civil right, using her art and her songs to strengthen the civil rights movement. And as we've come to know, this was something J. Edgar Hoover was against. and this is a fascinating film in that it picks up Billie just as her career is starting to really blossom, and shows that this chain of events that happened. So it's a dark film. It's a very unsettling film, but he's got a lot of her music in it, and that is just keeps it pretty glorious, because that was she was just a fantastic voice of that period of our culture, and really did help define a lot of that crossover from jazz being popular music into popular song of the later 50s. And that's a very traditional score, because her music was part of that, you know, the big melody type of music. So Lee wants a score that holds hands with that sort of songwriting. And so I'm going back into my that older style of scoring, where you have big themes and big gestures. And that's going to be a challenge and something I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on.
So it's just a little quick question. So sounds like you have several different projects going on all the time. Is that the way you normally kind of work?
Yeah, I love working. I find that every project that comes in the door offers me a new chance to learn something about music. And that keeps me young and interested. And I have no intention of stopping very soon. So when something like this comes in, I just, you know, it's going to be fine. Bill and Ted is almost done. Lee is just getting started. Nobody's getting shortchanged. I can handle the whole thing, and it's what I do. It's who I am.
Stuff.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there anywhere online that people could follow you on social media?
Yeah, I have a Instagram, Mark Isham, with the blue check. Oh my God, how did he do it?
There you go.
Seriously appeared someday. I have a website, markisham.com, I think. Yeah, it's very simple. I've managed to still own my own name on the internet, so.
Well, that's the most important thing, honestly. Yes.
So if you enter Mark Isham, you'll get me. You will get me.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Perfect.
Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a real joy and very enlightening. As I mentioned, Warrior really is one of my favorite movies of all time. And just even like I was so curious about it. And there's even an interesting story about some of the things. So this is a real pleasure for me.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me as well.